Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. Today, September 24, 2006. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on WILL AM 580. And beautiful, although not quite as beautiful as usual, Urbana today, this lovely Sunday. Today we're talking about the FCC, we're talking about media ownership and the raging fights and scandals that are taking place in Washington this fall as we run up to the November election. As I said at the beginning of the program, the FCC is returning to its deliberations and review of media ownership rules this fall, the same process that led to the explosion of public interest in media policymaking in the United States during the course of 2003. In conjunction with this, there has been a number of major studies, two in particular that weigh in on this subject, that have come out in recent weeks, as well as a scandal at the FCC as charges of repressed research that goes against the interests of the FCC majority have emerged in the past week or two. We're going to be talking about all that today on this episode of Media Matters. And joining us are two terrific guests to be here to provide their expertise and experience. We have Marvin Amori, the staff attorney for the Institute for Public Representation at the Georgetown University Law School. Marvin is a graduate of the University of Michigan, has his law degree from Harvard, and is an expert at media ownership law and First Amendment law. It's an honor to have him here. Marvin, welcome to the show.
Good to be here. Thank you, Bob.
Joining us also from Washington, this is a Washington-centric day, Derek Turner, the research director for Free Press, the group I'm connected to, which many of our listeners are familiar with, who authored the new report on minority ownership that was just released this week that was referred to in Media Minutes, and also authored a report that was released just a few weeks ago called Broadband Reality Check 2, which contained a lot of breakthrough information and analysis of the state of broadband communication in the United States today and its relationship to FCC and government policies. Derek, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Bob. Good to be here.
Well, it's great to have both of you. And let's start with media ownership as the issue I want to look at first and center the show on right now. For one thing, maybe, Marvin, you could give our listeners some background on media ownership and what the FCC is up to now.
Well, the FCC has long had ownership limits on the number of stations that any entity could own nationally or locally. And every 4 years now, based on congressional law, the commission relooks at its broadcast ownership rules. And right now, beginning in July of this year, the commission is in the middle of another proceeding deciding whether it should repeal or modify some of its broadcast ownership rules. There are about six rules at play involving radio ownership and television ownership.
Now, the rule that's gotten the most attention, I think, from the public has been cross-ownership. Could you explain what that is?
Well, the cross-ownership limit is a limit on, or the big cross-ownership limit is a limit on newspaper and broadcast cross-ownership in the same town. So somebody who owns a newspaper can't own a radio station or a TV station in the same town. And the idea behind that, a very good idea, I think, is that most people get their local news from the radio, TV, or newspaper in that town. And the idea behind keeping ownership separate is that the public shouldn't have only one source or fewer sources of local news. And that limit, the cross-ownership limit, the newspaper TV limit, and the newspaper radio limit, has been around since 1975. The Supreme Court unanimously upheld it against the First Amendment challenge. And it's served the country well, but now the commission, especially the chairman, seem intent on relaxing or repealing that rule. They tried in 2003 to relax it, but the Third Circuit, a federal court, rejected the FCC's attempt.
Now, Marvin, while we're at that point, Marvin Amori, could you explain? Why was it in 2004 that the federal courts threw out the Federal Communications Commission's attempt to relax media ownership rules? What was the basis for that decision?
Well, generally when a court reviews an agency decision, there are three different grounds on which it can reject what the agency did. One is that the commission could have done something unconstitutional, like violation of the freedom of speech, or that the commission violated a law of Congress, or that the commission didn't follow administrative procedures and didn't have enough evidence or didn't engage in reasoned analysis is how the term is used. Generally, the court found that what the commission did essentially violated the administrative procedures that an agency should follow. That is, the commission gathered evidence but didn't really weigh it very effectively, and then the decision-making it engaged in was just not very reasoned. It didn't make sense. The commission said, we're trying to do X, and then it adopted rules that did Y. And the court looked at that and just said, you can't adopt rules in that manner.
Derek Turner, why are the big media firms, the Gannetts and Clear Channels and Sinclairs and Tribune companies, seemingly so keen on having the limitation on cross-ownership lifted so they can own newspapers, radio, and TV in the same community?
Well, it's generally the held belief of these companies that they have economies of scale, and that if they can grow bigger, they're able to secure exclusive advertising contracts, and they're able to basically run their media enterprise as a monopoly, which guarantees them higher profits and less competition. But, you know, as the years have gone by, this conventional wisdom about the need for media to get bigger sort of hasn't really been holding true. I mean, you did see a large push towards these newspaper companies gobbling up television stations and other markets, but now a lot of them are deciding, well, maybe that wasn't such a good idea, and they're selling some of these properties back. So it's conventional economic theory, but in practice all the time, it's not really working out the way they had hoped.
Well, even if it did work out the way these large firms hoped, Derek Turner, would it necessarily be a good thing for the people who don't own these companies?
Well, not at all. I mean, so I think one of the interesting things that came out from these studies that were buried by the SEC that we alluded to earlier, the highlight was is that locally owned stations did more news. But one of the things that was sort of buried in there is that of the stations that did have newspaper cross-ownership, now recall that some stations that also own papers in the same market exist because they were grandfathered after 1975, but those stations did not produce any more local news. So this whole, you know, idea that somehow having a cross-owned newspaper will increase the amount of local news, it just doesn't hold up.
Well, you sort of jumped ahead, Derek, to the scandal that burst forth last week when the suppressed research was released by Senator Boxer. Could you give a little background on that for listeners maybe not familiar with it?
Certainly. Kevin Martin had a renomination hearing a couple weeks ago.
And Kevin Martin is the chair of the SEC.
Kevin Martin's the chairman of the SEC who took over after Michael Powell left the commission. And this is one of these events that's supposed to be very friendly. He brought his family, and everyone was laughing, having a good time. But Barbara Boxer actually did some good questioning of him. And the day before, someone had leaked to her staff a report that was written in 2004 by the FCC, by the Media Bureau, by two economists at the Media Bureau who did a fantastic job methodologically. They did a great report. And someone had leaked a copy to Boxer and telling her that this is the only available copy left, that all copies had been ordered to be destroyed by the Media Bureau, and that this copy had been smuggled out and copied and then faxed to her. And as I mentioned, the study said that locally owned TV news stations did 5.5 more minutes per 30-minute broadcast of local news. So that's a huge amount. That's a bunch.
I'll tell you, I was shocked when I saw that myself. I couldn't believe it was that much.
Yeah, okay. So, you know, a 30-minute broadcast is going to have about 8 minutes worth of commercials. So we're talking
maybe where you live, maybe 10 minutes for most people live.
Right. So we're talking at most 22 minutes worth of actual news time, and these stations are devoting a full quarter of that time to more local news, which is really startling. It also showed that network-owned and operated stations did less local news, about 2 minutes less per broadcast.
And that's the fancy term for saying the stations, local stations that are owned by either NBC, CBS, ABC, or Fox.
Right, right. So stations that are usually in the bigger cities like New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, markets like that. Larger stations, so station owners that own stations in markets all over the country did less local news. I mentioned the cross-ownership with newspapers showed no difference. Cross-ownership with local radio stations, those stations did significantly less news, 6 minutes less local news. So what we're seeing here is that this is a very well-done study that completely contradicts what the Chairman Powell at the time, what his stated belief of the industry was, and this study was deep-sixed. It was, you know, very well done, should have come out. You know, I assume somehow someone paid for this study, you know, at the Media Bureau to be done, but it was buried.
Now, who's responsible for this? Do we know?
Not at this point. I mean, Chairman Powell's denied knowing anything. Kevin Martin said he had never seen the study, which, as an aside, I think that's somewhat interesting that he takes over, you know, chairmanship of this very important commission and has no idea what past research has gone on in his commission, which is just strange.
Well, he was on the commission while this took place, too. He just wasn't chair.
Right, right. And, well, ostensibly, you know, you wouldn't really have expected him to see the study. You would have expected Michael Powell to know about it, but he denies it, which is, you know, again, a typical Bush administration thing of, I'm the leader of the organization, but I have no idea what's going on underneath me. Don't hold me responsible, please. But so that was on a Friday. The following Monday, yet another Deep Six study that was leaked to Barbara Boxer came to light. And there was really no reason for this one to be put the kibosh on. It was a study of the radio industry that had been going on ever since the horrible 1996 Telecommunications Act deregulated the radio industry substantially. And it had been done every couple of years, looking at what the effects of these policy changes were. And the study in 2003, again, very well done study, you know, methodologically very sound. The conclusions were pretty stark. It showed that from 96 to 2003, there was a 6% increase in the total number of stations, but a 35% decrease in the number of owners. So what that means is that you're having these mergers, you're having stations like Clear, or companies like Clear Channel gobbling up stations. Over the same time, there was a decrease in the listening audience, but an 87% increase in advertising rates. So what that tells you is that these companies that are buying up all these stations are becoming more like monopolies and raising the cost of advertising. Other things in the report, Clear Channel had about 65 stations in 1996. Now they have over 1,200. Really, a lot of this is not very newsworthy. I mean,
we've been talking about that for years here.
But for some reason, they felt the need to bury this and destroy copies and get rid of it. But,
fortunately, we can be sure these are the only two studies that have ever been buried at the SEC, right?
Well, no, not at all. And in fact, there's talk in D.C. that there actually may be more of these studies. And one thing we can point to is one of the economists that wrote the local television study, Peter Alexander, quietly released in some academic journals two additional studies in late 2004 that showed that as television markets become more concentrated, that the diversity of local news content is diminished. Now, the question is why didn't these studies come out under the guise of the SEC? You know, did Peter Alexander feel that he couldn't have released them under the guise of the SEC, so he quietly rewrote them as an academic and put them in a journal? You know, we don't know. So obviously there's been more work going on, and, you know, there's a so-called investigation going on at the SEC now to look into.
Is this an investigation where Kevin Martin's investigated himself, or do they have someone credible and independent who isn't on the payroll of a political party doing it?
Well, it's the SEC's inspector general. Maybe Marvin can speak more to this, but I don't really expect.
Yeah, Marvin, would you please, what do you know about this investigation process of these suppression of research that's going on at the SEC?
I don't know much about the inspector general. I know that several House members of the Democratic Party, Senator Boxer, and a lot of organizations asked for an investigation under the inspector general. And I'm guessing if that's what they were asking for, it's probably not a con job. It's probably going to be as good as we could expect.
Now, does every agency have an inspector general? I'd be honest, I hadn't really heard of this position until this came up. But what is this something that everyone's got their own inspector general?
I know the FCC has one. That's the agency I practice in front of the most.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is that the commission should be accountable for how it makes its decisions. And there are several different ways to ensure that they will be accountable. And the inspector general is one of those mechanisms. I'm not really an expert on the inspector general process.
Okay. Our guest today on Media Matters, Marvin Amari, who you just heard, Derek Turner, who you've also heard. Marvin Amari is a staff attorney for the Institute for Public Representation at Georgetown University Law School. Derek Turner is the director of research at Free Press based out of Washington, D.C. Turner is also the author of two brand new reports we're going to be talking about on the show. One is on media ownership by minorities and by women. The other is what is called Broadband Reality Check 2, the state of broadband in the U.S. compared to other countries and how it relates to policy, both of which undermine a lot of the conventional wisdom at the FCC and in Congress about both these issues. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for either of our guests or both our guests, the number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And let's turn now, if we can, Derek, to the report you issued this week, again, on media ownership by minorities and women. You did this report. And what were some of the findings that you came up with?
Well, okay, let me give you a little bit of background. in the U.S., broadcast radio and television licenses are handed out by the FCC to entities, and they are supposed to act in the public interest. A lot of this began in the era of segregation, so not surprisingly, many of these licenses were originally held by white males, and many of them stayed that way. But as the 20th century came to a close, Congress and the FCC realized that they needed to pay more attention to making sure that these licenses were in the hands of minorities and women. And the 1996 Telecommunications Act, as bad as it is, it does contain language in there that specifically says that the FCC needs to favor a diversity of media voices and that they need to pay close attention to handing out licenses to minorities and females. So the FCC began monitoring what the race and gender of owners are in the late 90s, but really did nothing with this information. The only really comprehensive studies on this were done by the Commerce Department all throughout the 1990s, but then as soon as the administration changed hands in 2000, these studies just mysteriously stopped.
These were studies of minority and female ownership of radio and television stations?
Exactly. And they were very well done studies that provided a nice sort of longitudinal analysis of how the industry was changing. But for some inexplicable reason, their budget got cut and they stopped doing these studies in 2000. So we really haven't had a good assessment of what the state of minority and female ownership is since then. So what we did was complete a census of each of the nation's television broadcast stations. There's about 1,350 stations. And what we found was that even though women comprise over half the U.S. population, they own less than 5% of the stations, which is abysmal. Minorities comprise over a third of the U.S. population and are growing each year, but they own less than 4% of stations, nearly 3% of stations.
But, I mean, we knew it was bad to begin with. How is it getting better over time, though, just moving slowly?
No, actually, so it's getting worse, which is really a shame because we also looked at the changes in other industries of the economy, and in every single sector but television broadcasting, getting better, but television broadcasting is getting worse, and this is despite the fact that the number of total stations has grown substantially over the years. So we're really seeing not much change there at all, but some other things we did that are really quite interesting is we tried to examine the effects of FCC policy on minority ownership and female ownership, and two big policy changes that came out of the late 90s were that duopolies were allowed, so an owner in a same market can now own more than one station. There's some restrictions on what kind of stations they can own. And also, the Congress directed the FCC to raise the national cap. So before, a particular owner couldn't reach more than 25% of the U.S. audience, but now they can reach far above that, above 35%. So we looked at those changes on effects of those changes on minority owners-owned stations and actually found that Of the stations that were lost, nearly every single one could be attributed to these changes in media policy, and that a substantial number of these sales would have been not permissible under the old ownership rules. So what we clearly see here is a pattern of deregulatory FCC policy harming minority owners when, in fact, the FCC has a congressional obligation to promote minority ownership.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Derek Turney, who just heard, the research director for Free Press, the public interest group out of Washington, D.C. Also joining us from Washington, Marvin Amari, the staff attorney for the Institute for Public Representation at Georgetown University Law School. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment, the number at Media Matters, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. We're talking about the FCC's review of media ownership rules, which is going on right now, becoming a raging issue with the scandal that's taken place in the past week in Washington, D.C. We'll also be talking about a little bit more later in the show, the state of broadband, net neutrality, and Derek Turner's report, Broadband Reality Check 2. Again, call in if you have questions or comments. And Derek, if people want to read a copy of the minority ownership study that you just released, they go to freepress.net, is that correct?
They can go to freepress.net, or they can actually go to stopbigmedia.com, which has a lot of new updates on the report and then reaction to the report. And it makes it easy for people to file a comment with the FCC in the current ongoing proceeding, which I highly encourage people to do. We need people to speak out and let the SEC know that these issues are important to them.
Marvin Amari, one of the things that you have a strong interest in as a public interest attorney at Georgetown is the question of what role the public has in helping the SEC craft media ownership rules. Historically, what role has the public played in this, and then how is that changing?
Well, historically, the public wasn't all that involved. It was seen as sort of an inside D.C. question, sort of technical question of how asset allocation for big companies. In 2003 or in 2002 and 2003, there was a wave of the public getting very involved. The two Democratic commissioners wanted public input. They sought public input. They held hearings. The commission itself didn't hold very many official hearings, I think one, but the Democratic commissioners held public hearings. The public filed up to 3 million comments in the proceeding, and the public seems very engaged now. The public, what that ended up happening is that generally the media ownership rules had been strict until 1996. Once they were relaxed and the government and the FCC kept trying to push them and push them, the public, I think, got fed up and has been very involved.
And now, what role did the hearings play, if any, in the 2004 court decision that overthrew the FCC's attempt to relax media ownership rules? Was that weigh into the decision at all?
I mean, officially, I don't think it does. There's no matter of legal doctrine that it does. But a court is gonna know that after the FCC, I mean, the FCC has an obligation to provide public notice to the people so the public can comment on proposed rule changes. And then they're supposed to weigh evidence and take into account what the public thinks. That's the point of what the commission is there for. They're an expert agency. And what you have is you have the commission in 2002 and 2003 not really paying attention to what the public wants. Right? The public opposed media consolidation overwhelmingly, and you've got the commission ignoring that. You've got Congress being angered by what the commission did. You've got the public up in arms, and you had very little notice to the public as to what the commission wanted to do. Usually an agency will actually put out a rule and say, here's what we're thinking of doing, public comment on it. That's not what the commission did. They said, we're thinking of changing rules, comment on it, and then later just adopted rules blindsiding the public. And so when the court saw that, they realized the commission really wasn't seeking public input, wasn't really using the benefit of any expertise, and they probably didn't take the commission's decision-making as seriously as they would have otherwise.
Now that Kevin Martin has replaced Michael Powell's chair of the FCC, is it fair to say that he's learned from these mistakes and he's sort of forging a new path that calls for much more public participation?
Kevin Martin, maybe. That's his rhetoric. Kevin Martin is a very, very smart guy, very astute politically, very, very smart and politically astute. And his rhetoric is that public input is very necessary. A lot of people in D.C. doubt that the chairman actually believes that because it's clear the public opposes media consolidation. And so one thing Kevin Martin did in the July notice to kick off the new proceeding is he said we're going to have six studies and we're going to have six studies and then six hearings around the country. Details will be forthcoming. You know, months later, we know there'll be one official hearing. I'm not totally sure what the studies will be, but he hasn't seemed all that eager to put together the hearings, and a lot of people think that he's not as sincere as he sounds, but he's very politically astute.
You know, Marvin Amari, we had a caller leave a question. They had to get off the phone. Okay. They were on a cell phone, but they had a question saying, aren't there laws against suppressing research that like was done at the FCC? And if that is the case, wouldn't it be impossible for the SEC to proceed and sort of relax media ownership rules in opposition to the logic of these suppressed studies until this matter was cleared up?
As a legal matter, there are probably laws on that. But as a political matter, that I think as a political and just as a policy matter is really the key issue. You know, if somebody at the FCC gets in trouble for the suppression, it's not as big a deal as just making sure that the commission actually does adopt its rules in an open, transparent way, and that the rules that actually affect millions of people will be done based on sound evidence that the public can analyze and the public actually understands why these rule changes would be made if they're being made.
Let me put it this way. I'm consulting you, Marvin Amari, now as an attorney on this. Let's say the FCC were to go ahead and relax the media ownership rules, get rid of the ban on cross-ownership and say, have at it, media companies, gobble up all the media in every community as you wish. and you were the attorney who had to challenge this in the courts. Mm-hmm. Would the fact that there were these reports that were suppressed that provided what appears to be significant evidence to contradict the logic of the decision of the SEC, would that be something that you would be looking at as you were putting your case together?
Well, Bob, we will be challenging these rules.
Okay, well, okay. I hope you aren't billing me.
And this firm, I mean, if we don't like them, and this firm did challenge these, was one of the lead counsel in the Prometheus case, and my boss argued the First Amendment issue before the Third Circuit. So we'll be very involved in it, and we'll be watching all the evidence in this matter, and especially the suppressed evidence that the commission isn't sharing. And we have a Freedom of Information Act request out right now that we filed in early August. We'd heard rumors of evidence that hadn't come out yet. And the FOIA request, the Freedom of Information Act request, is about a study that the FCC commissioned an outside party to do. And the FCC is getting back to us on that, but we'll have some more evidence. I'm not sure it's a suppressed study, but we'll have some more evidence that the commission has that hasn't seen the light of day when we get the information from that request. So we're trying to gather as much information as we can from the commission and other sources.
Derek Turner, maybe I think a lot of our listeners, in fact, I'm sure most of them, because I've been in this boat until fairly recently, probably don't understand how the Federal Communications Commission works and how it is that something, a study could be suppressed like that, no one would apparently know about it. I mean, how many people work there? What's the relationship of the five commissioners who are political appointments to the professional staff?
Well, I don't know exactly how many work there. I'm sure it's maybe in the thousands. But the way it works is there's five commissioners, one of which is the chairman. And the chairman controls what's basically all of the bureaus that report to the FCC. And so everyone is essentially under his direction. And so the big bureaus, all the thousands of people that work for the FCC are essentially under his direction. He keeps an eye on everything, or ostensibly keeps an eye on everything. The actual other commissioners, though, their staff is very small, you know, maybe no more than 10 or 15, mostly lawyers, a few interns, things like that. They don't really have much resources. So, for instance, Commissioners Copps and Adelstein, the two Democratic members of the commission, don't have their own resources to go and conduct a study. They can say to the Media Bureau, would you look into this? But ultimately, any decision about what goes on inside the Media Bureau is up to the chairman. So that's why, when I mentioned earlier, I think it's very telling that Kevin Martin takes over this chairmanship and doesn't bring the chief economist from the Media Bureau into his office and say, what kind of work have you guys done on media ownership? You know, did he do that? Did he not do that? If he did do that, did he know about the study? You know, it raises the question that either he's incompetent or he didn't really want to know what was going on. It's very telling that...
It's hard to believe that could ever take place in our government, but...
Right. Right. So...
So please proceed with the SEC. So there's a whole staff there, in other words, that is professional, that's independent, and the five commissioners, especially the four who aren't the chair, really aren't in the middle of everything.
No, the day-to-day activity is governed by the chairman. All the heads of all the bureaus report to him, the Media Bureau, the International Bureau, the Wireline Bureau. They all report to him, and they carry on the day-to-day activity of the commission and implement oversight of regulations and things like that, conduct studies, gather data. That all takes place under the role of the chairman. So that's why the position of the chairman is very important, because he sets the agenda and sets the pace of what's going on inside the bowels of the agency.
You're listening to Media Matters today on WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're coming to you live today from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And thank you so much for joining us today. If you'd like to call in with a question for our guest, Marvin Amore, the staff attorney for the Institute for Public Relations at Georgetown University Law Center, or Derek Turner, the research director at Free Press, the number here, 333-9455, toll free 1-800-222-9455. And Derek, let me just follow up on this, and Marvin, you can jump in too if you want. It's already been announced there will be one public hearing in Los Angeles on media ownership, where all five commissioners will be present to hear what the public has to say on the issue of relaxing media ownership rules or changing them. I mean, there's, I guess, theoretically, the discussion could be of tightening media ownership rules. Let me ask you that, Marvin. In the 1996 Telecommunications Act, is the only direction media ownership rules can be changed is to relax or loosen them, or can they go the other way?
They can go the other way. The media companies were arguing they could only go one way. But the issue was argued in the court, and the Third Circuit held very clearly that they could go the other way. And in the part of the decision where it held that, they were talking about the radio rules, which have led to massive consolidation. And I think the court kind of suggested that the commission should look into tightening those rules.
Okay, so back to the question then. These public hearings, the next one, the only official one's coming up in Los Angeles, Chairman Martin promised, or at least pledged in some manner, I don't know, the term promise is sort of doesn't mean anything in the English language anymore with politicians, but said he was planning to have six of these before the FCC held a vote and get public input. What have we learned from past hearings? What should we expect in Los Angeles based on what's happened in the past few years with other public hearings concerning media ownership, Derek?
Well, the first thing you're going to see is, well, first of all, we need to establish where the hearing's going to be. They've vaguely said Los Angeles, but they haven't really honed in on a place yet. And what I've heard is they're actually maybe moving the hearing out to El Segundo, which is sort of on the outreaches of L.A., which actually may make it harder for unions and other organizations in the public interest to actually get people out there. But what you will see, and you've seen in the past, are these.
Well, let me stop you on that. I mean, they're thinking about putting it in some out-of-the-way location. The idea of the hearings is to draw public people in, to make it, isn't it theoretically, to make it accessible so citizens who can't hire lobbyists in Washington, who aren't big shots, who can't fly in and have a private meeting with the commission, have an opportunity finally to speak about what's on their mind, and they're going around the country to hear public opinion. Why would you then locate the hearing in some suburban warehouse?
You know, I have no idea, but the shame of this is that if they go forward with this plan, it's in the middle of nowhere. I mean, you know, El Segundo has a right to speak on the issues just as any other location does, but the fact that they're holding it where they're not getting the maximum number of people is sort of suspicious. Also, the hearing starts at 3 in the afternoon, and, you know, hardworking people may not be able to take off of their job that early to go out and speak. So, but what you will see is that the industry will be very mobilized and ready for this hearing, and they're going to have plenty of people representing big media at this hearing. Probably some of them will be on the official list of speakers. To sort of try to balance out what is naturally overwhelming opposition to any kind of further media deregulation, to sort of paint a picture that, you know, the industry's nice, industry's not going to hurt you, industry works hard to protect the, you know, interests of the community, when in fact it's not really the case. So what you will see is a huge presence of big media out there. So Free Press has organizers on the ground, regardless if it's in El Segundo or Los Angeles or wherever it's going to be, trying to let people know that this hearing is going to be taking place and trying to mobilize as many people as possible to get out and speak their mind. And, you know, it may not matter much from a legal standpoint what kind of testimony takes place at these hearings, but it does matter from a political standpoint. If we get a huge turnout of these hearings and just overwhelming public opposition to deregulation, politicians in Congress are going to hear this. And, you know, it may not matter to the court proceeding, but it will matter to the court of public opinion and anything that does happen in Congress to maybe try to stave off rule changes if they do happen.
Now, Marvin Amore, if in fact Chairman Powell decides only to hold this one hearing in Los Angeles or in some warehouse district, you know, within an hour of Los Angeles, and doesn't decide to hold the other five he had at one time at least given some sense he was committed to, and then proceed with voting and relaxing the media ownership rule, specifically the cross-ownership rule, can he do that, or is there any way to legally stop him, to force him to listen to what the public has to say?
Legally, I think it might be difficult, depending on how he made the promise. If I remember where I got the number six from, it was from an FCC press release issued the same day as the notice. I can't remember if the notice had that exact number. So if, I mean, we'd obviously raise it in our pleadings when we challenge the rules, we challenge the rules. But I'm not sure if that would be enough to get the rules rejected, just that alone.
What would, I mean, in your view, Marvin, as an attorney who works specifically on these sorts of issues, what would be the appropriate amount of public input on something like media ownership rules?
Well, the appropriate amount would at least provide the public with notice of what the rules that the commission wanted to adopt were going to be. Right now, the only notice out there is, hey, we're thinking about the rules. Right, we have to think about them every few years. The commission should say, we're thinking of permitting an entity to own a newspaper and a broadcast station in the top 200 markets, or something like that. That way, if you're in market number 200, you can look around and you can say, wait a minute, FCC, that's a bad idea. I don't want this company owning that much of my media sources, and then you might file. So as long as the public has a better idea of what the commission is planning on doing, I think it would be a lot better for the public and a lot better for the commission's decision-making if they actually came out with another notice, which is what the Senate Commerce Committee signaled they should do, and which is what the Democratic commissioners have been arguing for, before they adopt any final rules. So we don't have to challenge them in court, and we can just have the public, again, comment on what the rules might be.
I want to turn now, if we can, on Media Matters, to the question of broadband and the report that Derek Turner authored that came out a couple of weeks ago, Broadband Reality Check 2. But before I go to that, I do want to let listeners know that if you're interested in following up on the question of media ownership and FCC hearings and the suppression of the FCC's research on the effects of concentrated media ownership, I think if you go to the Stop Big Media page, and Derek, that's stopbigmedia.com, is that right?
Stopbigmedia.com, you can go to it directly, or of course from freepress.net, we have links to it as well.
And stopbigmedia.com is the website that's put together. It's a consortium of 40 groups that are working on the media ownership campaign, pretty much cut across the political spectrum, is that right?
Right, it's a coalition website, and there's people from all walks of politics that are opposed to these changes. This is not a Democratic Republican issue. This is a people issue. So,
well, let's turn now, if we can, Derek, to your study, which I found extraordinary, that came out a couple of weeks ago, Broadband Reality Check 2. And why don't you tell people why you did the study and what some of your findings were?
Well, okay, Bob, let me give you a sort of the reason we do these kind of things is because there's so much on the other side. The industry funds these coin-operated think tanks to turn out just garbage documents that sort of paint the picture that they want. And there's a strong need for some good research on the public interest side. You know, for example, the other day I turned on Flip and C-SPAN, and they had a luncheon at the Progress and Freedom Foundation, which is one of these telco-funded think tanks. And the CEO of Comcast was on there crowing about how the broadband sector is very competitive. There's huge competition, and one of the examples he cited is that they're increasingly facing competition from community wireless projects. And no, he should have been struck down by lightning at that point, because there was no sense of irony in what he said, because the fact that he was speaking at a luncheon run by an organization who is funded by Comcast, who has been in the states and attempting to get laws passed to ban community wireless projects. So it was just very, very disheartening to hear him say that. But that's the reason we do these studies, is to give American public a real picture about the state of broadband. But
shouldn't these studies be done by the FCC? I mean, shouldn't, like, the same economists who did the very good work on media ownership, shouldn't these sort of people be working on this as well?
Well, they should. And the thing is that a lot of the data, the raw data I use for the Broadband Reality Check 2 and Broadband Reality Check 1 came from the FCC. They do gather data that can then be used. You know, data is just data. It takes analysis to turn it into information. And the FCC just really does a poor job of turning their data into information. And it's not that surprising. Kevin Martin goes and writes editorials twice a year stating how fierce the competition is in the broadband sector, when in fact we know it's not. To give you an example, I live in Falls Church, Virginia, which is about 5 miles outside of D.C. I live right across the street from the metro line, so it's a very high-dense population area. And in a condominium that was built maybe 9 years ago, I only have access to a single provider. I only can get cable modem service. I can't get DSL in my building. But if you look at the FCC's data, their zip code data, which I talk a lot about in the report, according to them, in my zip code, there's 12 unique providers of broadband, which is just garbage. I mean, you know, I don't know how they're really coming up with that number. They don't really disclose that too much. But you know,
I mean, that's absurd. I mean, there's nowhere in the world or in this country that you have 12 choices for broadband providers, is there?
Not at all. Not at all. The way they're able to overstate that is, first of all, you know, you tell me if this makes sense. To gauge the measure of broadband deployment, they use this so-called zip code methodology. And the way it works is that in a given zip code, if a provider serves at least one subscriber, then they're counted as serving that zip code. So, you know, you could be living in the middle of nowhere, and you could have a single person subscribing to a very expensive and slow satellite service, and then now that zip code is considered as broadband deployed in it. Well, you know, it's not the case at all. So in my case, my zip code says 12 providers. Well, what does that mean? That means someone in my zip code may subscribe to a satellite provider. There may be a Verizon customer, a Sprint customer, a Singular customer that all have very slow broadband on their telephones. There may be one Verizon DSL customer or several or whatever. There's cable customers. So they're able to inflate the actual number, but they don't give you information about what the level of competition is. And so in Broadband Reality Check, we actually use some Government Accountability Office data, which they went and showed that the FCC says there's a median number of 8 providers available to the average consumer in the U.S., when in fact that's 2. And that rings true with what we all know is our experience. Most people have access to the local phone company's DSL offering or the local cable company's cable modem offering. They're products that are tied to the services, so you have to subscribe to phone or you have to subscribe to cable television to get a deal, to get a decent rate. It's expensive, it's slow, and it in no way is the market at all competitive. So
the good news, though, of course, is that since we invented the Internet here, our services clearly got to be much better than anywhere else in the world.
Well, no. In fact, that's not the, you would think that would be the case, but it's not the case at all. The report details in ad nauseum that in many other countries in the world, in Asia and Europe, that their broadband, though it came after ours, is becoming much, much faster, much cheaper. There's much more competition. And the report attempts to trace the source of this competition. Now, you'll often hear Kevin Martin and other people crow about the reason the U.S. is so far behind is because we're such a very big country and we have a low population density. Well, using econometric techniques, we blow that myth away. The population density does not affect the difference between penetration in different nations. What does affect the difference is policy, and this, again, comes back to policy. And all these countries that are bypassing us in broadband, they have what's called open access policy. And, again, the U.S. invented open access policy. It was a part of the 96 Telecom Act. But over here...
What does open access policy mean, Derek?
Okay, open access policy. Well, just imagine that, you basically have a pipe coming into your home that's run by the telephone company. They essentially have a monopoly over that pipe. It was not economically feasible for another company to reproduce their infrastructure. So what open access policy does is says, phone company, you must lease access to your lines at a reasonable rate. You can still make a profit off these lines, a decent profit at that, but you need to let competitors access your lines. And, these competitors can then offer their own services, hopefully competing with you and causing you to innovate and invest. So in Europe, they've used open access policy to work amazingly. So, for instance, in France, the France Telecom, the main telecom provider there, was really slow to roll out any kind of broadband, any kind of DSL offerings. But because of open access, there was a company called Free who then deployed their own DSL modems and rolled out a broadband offering, which then caused France Telecom to say, hey, well, maybe we should get in this business too. Then now they are rolling out higher broadband. They're rolling out gigabit speed broadband, which is unheard of here in the U.S. And you see this happening all over Europe, in the Netherlands, in Germany. It's happening in Asia. Open access, the threat of competition creates innovation, and it's not what the telecom companies tell you here in the U.S. is that please protect us from competition so we'll invest, but it's exactly the opposite. And if you look at the record, which the report does, you see over and over again competition created by policy, created by regulatory policy, then causes these companies to innovate and invest. But when you remove that competition, remove that threat of competition, they act like monopolists, which is exactly what you would expect. They reduce output, they raise prices.
My name is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters. Our guest today, Derek Turner, you've just been listening to, research director at Free Press based in Washington, D.C. Our other guest, Marvin Amari, staff attorney for the Institute for Public Representation at the Georgetown University Law Center. We have a couple of callers who've been waiting patiently. Let's get to them now. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to make a comment about the last discussion about the grandfathering and of the joint ownership. We have the test case here in our community where the newspaper owns 2 radio stations that are grandfathered in, and I have a feeling that as well as some, cutthroat advertising rates, that the synergy of having those 2 stations had something to do with the other newspaper going away in 79. So, and by way of announcement, the IMC is hosting this net neutrality forum. I think it's the 27th on a Wednesday of October. No. Let's see.
Well, don't worry. I'll announce it before the event to make sure our listeners are familiar with it.
But I was just going to urge people to suggest that Tim Johnson actually do show up because his opponent is going to be there, and the word is that he's just going to send a statement to that effect. But I think we should have also talk about net proactivity in the sense that we should be seeing broadband as a informational right, as it were, and actually start talking about processes and subsidies. I mean, obviously this isn't new to me because even Newt Gingrich said we were going to give away laptops and connect people to the Internet some years ago. So I just think that we ought to go beyond neutrality and the whole common carrier language and the idea that this is really a subsidy from the Defense Department that, that started the Internet to begin with. And that, of course, these large corporations are building faster lines and things like that. But for the advantage that they've gotten from the whole thing phenomena happening at all, they should play fair and not as you've been saying, keep the free lane for themselves and leave the frontage road for the for anybody else.
Well, I've got good news for you. Our guest, Marvin Amari, that is a belt-high batting practice pitch for him. This is right up his alley. So, Marvin, thinking about the right to broadband, or broadband is something that the government, the public should invest in to make it as a diverse to the whole, or available and accessible to the whole population. Is there a legal basis for that in American history?
Yeah, there's absolutely a legal basis for that in American history. The basic tenet of communications policy in the U.S. has been to encourage wide dissemination of information from diverse sources. And one indication of that would, say, be universal service policies that telephone companies that regulated telephone companies, universal access, universal service. There's also long been regulations on, say, cable companies that local governments would force them to serve everyone in the community, not just the very wealthy, not just the most profitable. And so there's definitely a legal basis for it. There's historical basis. There's Supreme Court precedent. And it's a good thing. Everyone should be a part of the communications everyone should be connected to each other. I mean, we're one community, and everyone should have enough information to make political decisions, not just those who can afford it.
Derek Turner.
Bob, let me add to that real
quick. I do want to. Derek, as you add to it, discuss the digital divide and what the prospects are for eliminating it if, in fact, we continue with the current policies that Commissioner Martin and the Republican leadership of Congress wish to pursue.
Well, the digital divide is alive and sick and not well in the U.S. You know, the digital divide existed back when it was just a dial-up market, and the digital divide continues to persist now that it's becoming a broadband market. And there's sort of two digital divides. There's a digital divide between rich and poor, and there's a digital divide between people who live in rural areas and people who live in urban areas. And policy can help to solve this problem. Now, you know, our report actually showed that, you know, a lot of what you hear, the refrain you hear from industry types is that, well, you know, there's no reason to subsidize broadband or to subsidize building out broadband or to encourage build out of broadband networks because poor people can't afford computers to connect to the Internet. So unless we solve the computer problem, there's no point in trying to get them broadband. But what we actually showed is that both rural and low-income families use computers in just the same ways that rich and urban families do. So it's not the lack of a computer that's getting them off the fast lane. It's the price of the connection is the most important factor in keeping them off.
How do our prices compare to other countries in, say, Europe or Asia?
Well, it's completely out of whack. I mean, there's several ways you can think about it. So you can think about just the price of the connection alone, or you can think about what you're actually paying for, how fast your connection is. And, you know, other countries, their speeds are some 10 to 20 times higher than ours for about half the price. It just depends on where you are. And in Europe, you see the proliferation of so-called triple play services where they're getting broadband connection, television, phone, all for less than what we pay over here. So prices are out of whack. Prices aren't really falling. Cable prices are going up. DSL prices have dropped slightly over the years, but they're actually rolling out slower connections. That accounts for much of the price drop in DSL. So you're continuing to see a digital divide between rich and poor because poor people cannot afford these connections, but they have computers, they want to get online, you're using dial-up connections, but the monopoly or duopoly markets is keeping prices artificially high and keeping them out of the hands of low-income and rural families.
And your argument and the argument of the report is that there are policies that created this bad situation, and similarly policies can make solve the problem.
Right. I mean, if we moving back to the regime of open access would be a good idea. As the caller sort of alluded, you know, broadband should be thought of as public infrastructure. We built highways in this country, you know, in the 50s. Why can't we build the information superhighway? Why can't we start in rural areas and roll out fiber to the home? You know, it would cost, on average, maybe $1,000 per household to wire the entire country. So we're talking $100 to $200 billion, which is, you know, a substantial amount of money. But if you think about how much we spend on this war or what we spend
on... you can't even invade a large country for that.
Right. The other thing is we spend $7 billion a year on the Universal Service Fund, but a lot of that is used to prop up these old telephone networks by inefficient operators in rural areas. And sort of what we suggest is that, you know, perhaps it's time to move the universal system away from a dial tone metric to a bits metric and start subsidizing the build-out of broadband networks in rural areas. And I think that would transform, you know, the way that our economy works if rural people were just as connected as people in urban areas.
Well, Marvin Amari, Derek Turner, we've only got a minute or so left. Have either of you ever heard of Farina, Illinois?
I have not.
I didn't think so. How about you, Marvin?
No, I haven't.
It is a hotbed of Media Matters listenership. We have two callers who frequently call from there, and I think it's a population of 600 people. So let's go to our caller from Farina now. Farina, welcome to Media Matters.
Hi, thanks so much. I'm going to overstate the obvious, that there's a political agenda from the corporate elite to, on both topics, the suppression of freedom of speech from the left and just people that want the American way to succeed. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Marvin, we've only got about a minute left, so do you have a closing comment? You can tee off from that, or just something you'd like to say to our listeners concerning what's taking place in Washington today.
Okay. Well, the first caller began with cross-ownership again, newspaper, radio. And one thing that we've heard both in the press and rumor is that the chairman seems to want to peel off that one part of the ownership proceeding and decide it early or separately. So that's one concern that really what it comes down to is the chairman's very concerned. He really wants to repeal a rule that matters a lot, the cross-ownership rule, the newspaper television rule, and that we should keep our eye on that issue as well because he might try to sneak that one through.
And go to stopbigmedia.com to stay on top of that issue.
Exactly. Great website.
Okay. Derek, do you have a closing comment for our listeners, what you'd like to have them keep in mind?
Well, you know, I would suggest they go to stopbigmedia.com, download all the materials, read the reports, and file a comment with the FCC. It matters. Someone has to sit there and read all these comments and, you know, try to personalize your comments, give anecdotal stories about the media in your location. Tell the FCC how you see media changing over the years.
When's the deadline for to file a comment?
Well, it's actually been extended, thanks in part to Free Press and some other organizations filing saying, Chairman Martin, you need public input before you make this decision. So now the initial comments are due October 23rd. The final comments are due December 21st.
Well, Derek, on that note, I want to thank Derek Turner. I want to thank Marvin Amori for being my guest today. I'm Bob McChesney, your host of Media Matters. I'm going to be back in 1 week. And, of course, as always, Brett Polson, the engineer, and John Anderson sitting in as producer this week. Thanks so much, John Anderson. See you all in 1 week. Bye-bye, folks.